It is Saturday, August 26, 2006, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California. Today, we're taking your calls, and we're covering geek news.
Geek Speak is a production of KUSP, Central Coast Public Radio, kusp.org. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
It's time now, of course, for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed on our program are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on Geek Speak, we're taking your calls with questions and comments about technology in the second half. And of course, the first half, we're doing geek news. The phone numbers for half an hour from now are 476-2800, toll free at 1-800-655-5877, or contact us now. Go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. I'll give out that information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air and with me are geeks. Drew Meyer, product manager at Network Appliance, and Miles Elam, technical trainer at Surf Control. Geeks, welcome to Geek Speak.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So we're going to be covering people's calls, questions and comments about technology in the second half of the show. The first half, we'll just do some geek news of the week. And I'd like to start with you, Drew.
Oh, wow. Let's see. Apple recalls 1.8 million batteries. And I know last week and the week before, we've been talking about the Dell recall. There's a Sony's battery cell technology, there's a risk of using it. It's kind of the root of Dell's problem as well. And Dell's is much more significant, much larger, which probably reflects the market size penetration there.
Mm-hmm.
Users are advised to remove the batteries immediately and store them in a safe place.
Safe place meaning someplace they can take some explosion?
Yeah, fireproof box. A safe. I don't know. This lithium-ion batteries can overheat, posing a fire hazard. So jets of flame, as we've seen in internet videos, may come emitting from your Macintosh.
So what laptops are available? You know, which machines are problematic?
It's the iBook G4 and the PowerBook G4 laptop models, sold between October 2003 and August of 2006.
Uh-oh.
Pretty good spread there.
There's two in the air room right now.
Oh my gosh. I'm going to move over here.
You have a PowerBook G4. You got it after 2003 probably?
Yeah.
And mine definitely.
Both of them are PowerBooks?
Both of them are PowerBooks. I'm not actually running off my battery right now, but I'm charging my battery. So at any moment, if there's a burst of flame, I'll burn my hands while throwing it out the window.
It's about 32% of the 5.5 million laptops that they've shipped during that period, which is, you know, significant quantity.
Okay, so we have a 30% chance of our laptops actually having problems. So does that, I mean, obviously it's not like 30% of those laptops explode, but 30% of them have this potential risk.
Yeah, they must have sourced the parts from Sony that sells that have overheating problems.
So contact Apple if you've got a machine like that, and hopefully they'll send a little battery out to you while you wait. Kind of scary, but thank you for that, Drew.
I don't think you need to worry about catching on fire, but just pay attention.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Miles, I'll go to you for news.
There's a group called the JCB Dieselmax that has...
I believe you.
Yes.
Already, I believe.
What does that mean?
That has made a... Well, it's just the company name. Relax,
okay,
folks.
A company.
All right.
Reporting the first entirely computer-designed car.
Meaning they've never done no modeling? Or they've done no, like,
where the human beings weren't doing the modeling for it.
Oh, they, you mean designed by computers?
Yes.
So, okay.
Oh, wait. No, I'm sorry. I take that back. You are right. Entirely computer-designed car. There wasn't any physical modeling.
Okay.
It was all done by computer. It has broken the diesel speed record. You know, so this first completely computer-designed car has then gone on to completely
They actually then physically built it.
Yes, so okay. They actually physically built it.
In our specs, it works perfectly.
Now, the previous record, this is actually pretty interesting. The previous record was set in 1973 and was 236 miles an hour. The current record is now 328 miles per hour.
Wow.
I mean, they completely smashed the previous record. But
wow. Yeah.
Is there really that much difference in diesel versus petrol for cars?
Well, there's a higher energy
gasoline.
Density.
So, but I mean, why are they racing? Why do you separate the racing of a vehicle by its fuel source?
Diesel engines have a lot of torque, but they don't go fast.
Okay,
they're very reliable, very very stable. The fuel is very.
But doesn't that just have
easily?
To do with transmissions and just having more steps up the chain of the
I don't know enough about it.
Maybe that's complicated.
Nobody
in itself.
Does it. Yeah, there must
okay.
be a reason.
So you don't normally race them. You normally like gasoline powered. Car for racing. So this is kind of big that...
If you know the answer to this question, send us, because now we want to know.
Yeah. It was also interesting, though, that this is a car that is completely designed on the computer. Like, they had sure. all the design done, and then went, okay, our design's done, let's build it. And having it, by and large, they had to do some tweaks, obviously,
sure.
with any design you have to. But then having it go...
Very well, effectively.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's talk...
This is a set of record, as it were.
Let's do an update on news from last week. Last week, we were talking about Pluto being on this stage of, is it a planet or is it not a planet? And the International Astronomical Union was having a giant meeting, and they had this very lively debate. And last week, when we did our show, we were in the middle of that debate, so we didn't know the outcome. But it looked like it was leaning towards Pluto's going to be a planet, and if Pluto's going to be a planet, then all these other objects out there, like five more objects are going to be a planet, we're going to have like 13 planets, and oh my gosh. Turns out, what's the outcome, Miles?
That they decided to demote Pluto. It's no longer saying that it's a planet. They're calling it, with a new designation, of a dwarf planet.
So they want to make it not just an asteroid or a rock. They're going to give it a special name, dwarf planet.
Right. But it's, because it's still somewhat spherical, but it is somewhat irregular, and it has what was previously described as a moon, but another object, Charon, that was... it was like a dual planet system. So now they're just talking about it being a dual dwarf planet system.
Pluto showed up about 70 years ago, so it's been a planet for about 70 years. That's the classification. And then almost the entire time, at least in the last 40 years, there's been a heated debate whether it should be or not. And this is kind of pushed to a head from the whole discovery of Xena, which is another object in the what was called the trans-Plutonian objects, right? The Kuiper belt? Is that the right?
Kuiper
belt.
Kuiper.
Kuiper. So they found this other object that was larger than Pluto, and then they're like, well, then that's a planet too, and there'll be more of them. So
wait, which object did they find that was larger than Pluto?
Xena.
Oh.
Yeah.
That was actually larger than Pluto?
I believe it's larger than Pluto.
I didn't realize it was larger.
It's not as large as the Pluto and its moon together, but I believe it is, and I could be wrong. In any case, what I want to say was that the debate happened, and it was going on, and I love the way that they solved it finally. After this long debate, there's all these astronomers in the room, and they call for a vote, and they raise their hand whether Pluto's a planet or not, and no. So we have eight planets. We officially have eight planets: Mercury, Earth, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune.
So
no more Pluto.
What about Ceres, which was going to be one of the new
one
planets?
One of the new planets.
So is that now a dwarf planet?
I would assume that all those are dwarf planets at this point.
Okay. And because it's big enough that it is spherical, and so, or at least largely
spherical.
The
old definition. Right.
Right. And so it's bigger than what you would normally consider an asteroid.
One of the things they're saying is that this in this new model, this new argument, they're saying that the body has to clear up the debris in its orbital path, meaning that any other debris in the orbital path of that object has to be kind of slowly consumed by this large mass. And if it doesn't do that, it's not considered a planet. If it doesn't do that, it's considered a dwarf planet. So if you look in our orbital path of Earth, the Earth and Moon have sucked up anything else that's in that path. You know, you don't find anything but micrometeors. And most of those times, those are actually going through our orbit rather than orbiting the Sun at the same spot. But out there, it's just kind of a mess of stuff.
Yeah,
orbiting
but
around.
The Moon is going away from us. So we're not... I mean, are we a planet? We're not...
Yes, we're a planet. Thank you. Let's go to the next story from Drew. Hi.
Speaking of the solar system, let's bring that home a little bit. This week, Governor Schwarzenegger signed the Million Solar Homes Bill in California, which is a fantastic... Well, I'm a big fan of this.
Yeah.
It allows the state of California will now be putting a about $15 a year additional rate increase on public utilities customers, residential customers, and using that to provide funding for a $3.2 billion program that will create 3,000 megawatts of clean solar power, or about 5% of the state's total need during the next decade, by allowing rebates for consumers to put solar panels on their homes.
Wow.
And by now requiring new home construction to offer solar as a standard option.
Okay, cool.
So you can get solar
if you're building. That's a really cool package.
Super cool. I think it is, and I'm sure there are people who don't think this is a good idea, but I haven't read anything that's convinced me yet otherwise. And I'd love to hear from you if you're out there and you think so.
Do you know if this additional approximately $15 per customer is just for residential or for all electrical use in California? Are you aware?
I don't know if it's limited to residential. It's certainly targeting residential.
It is targeting residential in the rebates as well.
I remember a little while back there was an initiative trying to go through the state government talking about the million solar roofs.
Yeah,
I think this is what the results of that.
Some of the naysayers are saying, well, it's just a drop in the bucket. It doesn't make any difference.
It's only 5% of energy use, for
but
example.
Schwarzenegger's saying we're going to become a leader, and he used the cell phone analogy. The more people buy this, the lower the price comes. And it just should make a significant difference. Right now it costs around $15,000 for an average homeowner and could bring it down to $2,000.
This is pretty exciting because a while ago, I noticed that that was the rebate on hybrid cars. That was what was changing. That's right. PG&E was going to slow down the process and not allow people with new systems to come online to buy back power. They're going to stop it. So basically, this initiative is going to allow people to keep building houses with solar on it.
Well, it continues to fund the programs. It allows new construction to have this as an option, mm-hmm. which is, you have to go out of your way otherwise to get that to happen and do it independently. And most importantly, I forgot what I was going to say. One of the provisions of the bill is that you can now sell power back to the utility and get a credit for it beyond consumption of your own. Yeah, so you can actually make money by selling it a little bit back to a certain cap. You can't generate a gigantic amount and sell a pack and make tons of money, but you can get paid more than you are today.
Well, see, that I think is such a great idea, not because I think a lot of people are going to be selling back. Solar doesn't have quite the same output. So it'll reduce power draw during the day, and that's great. At the same time, if it encourages people to conserve or try to get it so that they can push back, even if they don't make it, even if they're trying, that's still going to make a huge dent.
Now, another thing that I mean, this isn't as important for home use, but I've been seeing a lot of talk about the next generation or following generation of hybrid vehicles being plug-in hybrids so that you actually have a larger power pack. People actually retrofitted their hybrid vehicles, existing Priuses, to add battery packs that are normally lead acid batteries, which aren't as safe, but to get large battery packs in your Prius, and then you operate it as like an electric car almost all the time. But any hybrid could do this if the company just made it available as maybe an add-on to the vehicle. Now you're talking about having a plug-in electric vehicle that when you need to go long trips is operating as a hybrid. I hope that I have enough money by the time these things come out to get one of these. I think that's the perfect solution. And then having a lot of electricity around, having solar energy, for example, means you're potentially charging your car. I know that you're not really
the amount
home,
of output from the sun. I don't know how much it's going to help because moving a car takes a fair amount of energy.
Well,
plug-in hybrids.
If you're at work, I work at Network Appliance, which has a campus in Sunnyvale. Sunnyvale has, I don't know, maybe 300 or probably more sunny days a year. And if I'm sitting there plugged in during work all day, easily I could charge battery. I could make a significant charge difference and put that into my energy commute going home.
If you can get solar panels at work.
Sure.
Right. But that's assuming, I mean, how many people are going to be having plug-in hybrids? If you have multiple people going there and you're splitting up that load, there's still a fixed amount of sunlight that's hitting.
When you do the math and find out how much solar power you need to charge your vehicle for a 20-hour drive or for a 20-mile drive, you know, and see how many sun hours of square footage you need.
Yeah,
but don't forget too that
that's quite a lot.
The other companies in the area that have solar cells on their roof that don't have any one of the plug-in hybrid are contributing to mine.
Yeah. See, one of the big models behind a plug-in hybrid though wasn't necessarily going in and plugging in at work, although I still recommend people would do that. It's that you would drive during the day, and most people don't drive more than, you know, what was it, 40 miles a day, 50 miles a day, and then you go home and you're charging your battery. charging your car battery from the home network.
Which is at night.
Which is at night.
Peak hours.
Yeah, exactly, because you can't turn power plants off.
You'd be charging from the grid, from the utility.
Exactly, but the power plants, you can't... the amount of power being drawn at nighttime is so much lower than at daytime, but you can't turn off a power station.
Right.
That power is still being generated, just no one's using it.
The other thing, of course, it does is that you now have your waste of your vehicles, because when a plug-in hybrid is in electrical-only form and it's got no exhaust at all, because it's just electrical, you're transferring the carbon dioxide production, even though it's very low on most hybrids, to the power plant coal burning, which is mostly how we're powered in California, where you can put in more infrastructure to clean the air that comes out of the plant. So you're getting a more concentration of where your exhaust goes.
Well, it's also a lot more efficient. I mean, the way that cars are now, with where you have millions of points of pollution, it's probably the most polluting way of doing it. Even if you have a power plant, even if our grid were completely 100% powered by coal, it would still be cleaner with plug-in hybrids than having the cars as they exist today.
Right. Oh, well, that was a fun little story. Thank you very much, Drew, for keeping us abreast on solar energy.
It's pretty cool. By the year 2017, there could be, if this works, 1 million solar homes in the state of California.
What year?
2017.
That's
10 years from now.
That's great.
And by the way, Arch from Aptos wrote in saying, hey, there are diesel-powered automobiles. The Le Mans this year was won by a diesel-powered Audi.
Oh, on racetracks.
On a racetrack, yeah.
Okay. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are Drew and Miles. And Miles, it's your turn for a news bit.
Actually, it was a bit of a follow-up on what we were talking about in terms of Pluto.
Mm-hmm.
This is kind of a turf war between the geologists and the astrophysicists of the world.
Okay.
The International Astronomical Union were going to use the word Pluton to describe a round object orbiting the sun with a period of more than 200 years. In other words, it takes more than 200 years for it to revolve around the sun.
So you're going to say a Pluton is any plutonium-type object?
Well, it's something that is, you know, around the orbit of Pluto and beyond.
Okay. So basically, instead of using dwarf planet, they're going to call it Pluton.
Well, at first they were going to.
Okay.
Or that was just going to be the designation for them to skirt the issue of calling it a planet. They were just going to have this other designation. These are these objects that are out there. Because the Kuiper Belt has a huge number of objects, ranging from the size of a pebble to the size of, well, Pluto. Or Xena, depending upon...
I haven't looked it up.
But at the same time, there was a big row that was formed over this because the Geologic Society was saying, wait a second, we're already using the word Pluton. What are you doing to us? This is especially coming to the fore because geologists and... astrophysicists, there's a lot in common. You know, worrying about looking at the geology of Mars, for example, has been one of the big pushes behind the Mars rover modules, or the Mars rovers. And so now you're running about, like, what to call it. Does one group have precedence over another? And it also brings up the issues of a lot of disciplines, they live in their own ivory towers, that they don't speak to one another, they don't share information, they're not working on a common lexicography, common namespace.
But you can't do a common... in a lot of ways, it's hard to do a common namespace because everybody uses terms... Your vocabulary would be so much larger that it kind of makes sense to have different disciplines using the same terms for different things.
I don't know if that's necessarily true.
Really?
Because there are a lot of folks that will have the exact same thing but use two different terms for it. That happens all the time in academia.
Okay, it would make sense if they had the exact same thing to use the same term. But there's also situations where one group of people will use a term and another group of people use a term, and it's the same name, but it's applied to different, totally different things. We talk about, I'm trying to think of a geek term that's used by other sources.
I was actually, one thing that has nothing to do with computers, but the term extinction in psychology refers to the removal of behavioral modification, or behavioral conditioning, I should say. But at the same time, extinction in biology refers to the elimination of a species.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and at the same time, I think of, well, wouldn't psychology and biology have a lot of crossover?
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't that cause some confusion? Wouldn't it be better have a common, like saying extinction is the elimination of species, and having some other word for the removal of behavioral conditioning? especially because behavioral conditioning can, or the removal of it, extinction in psychology, can be reversed easily. It's easier than making the conditioning in the first place, whereas extinction in the biological context
is pretty bad.
It, for all intents and purposes, is permanent.
All right. Should we start? Go ahead and start taking some calls? Let's go ahead and take this question from Nick from Royal Oaks. He's got Windows 98 machine, is trying to connect to the web and failing all the time. The machine locks up. What can he do about this?
Well, got any more? Help
well,
us out
that's all we got. I guess we could take him. You know, we could ask him.
Is he on the phone?
Him. Yeah, yeah.
Poor
should
bugger.
We, should we ask him?
Bring him in.
All right. Nick, welcome to Geek Speak.
Yeah, I have Towers 500, and it was given to me, and it's completely new to me. So I signed up AOL 7.0, and the first thing is the little icon is only going E-Towers D. I don't know what that is, but I go into the website, and it dials up and puts it on, and I can't use my mouse. I can't. Nothing will move, and it won't even close.
Okay, so it sounds like AOL is crashing when you connect to the internet. It's possible that it has to download a whole bunch of stuff, that it's trying to download things, and you have to wait. But I more likely the machine is the operating system needs to be reinstalled, and some work needs to be done on the machine. Do you have a lot of how important is this to you? Is it financially important to you?
You mean like getting a new computer?
Yeah.
Well, this was given to me, and yeah, I'm really out of the range to get a new computer.
Yeah,
I just had my father give me the first edition of the 98 NIT, and then that wasn't dialing up, so I came across the second edition, so I took it in. And now I'm with this problem.
Yeah. Well, it could be a hardware problem, I guess, with your modem and drivers for the modem. Geeks, you guys got any suggestions on what he can do with a brand new 98 machine or machine new to him?
No, it's a 1999.
Right, but the software is Windows
98. It's Windows 98's running on it, right?
Yeah.
All right, reinstall Windows 98. Don't use AOL. I know that's not very pleasant.
I don't know. Microsoft has end-of-lifed Windows 98.
I know.
They're not getting any security updates for it anymore, so...
Are there any switches? I came across, before I could even remember or write it down, something said that a switch was shut off.
Mm-hmm. That doesn't make any sense to me. I need more information. Mm-hmm.
No, that doesn't really... There's no switches specifically
not
that would...
Not physically, then.
It's a Windows... It's a 1999 machine, which means that you could be using... He could. I mean, the modem could be non-detecting. You said the modem's dialing, though?
It's dialing, yeah.
You're using this with a regular telephone line?
Phone line, yeah.
See, the thing is, if he switches away from AOL, it's just going to be more complicated to set it up.
Well, but what's the goal here that you're trying to... What do you really want to do with this, Nick? Surf the internet, get email, communicate with other people?
Webcams and...
You're not going to have any luck with a webcam on a 56K modem, my friend.
I mean, well, you will. It'll just be very, very slow.
Yeah.
I would say that have you reinstalled 98? Have you installed a new operating system on this machine?
I don't really understand what that is.
Since
well,
you
the
got
computer,
it, has
the
it
computer
ever
that you
changed?
Came, yeah, when you got this computer, have you put in a CD and gone through a long process of what's called reinstalling the operating system? You said that you had Windows 98 first edition, and then you had the second edition.
Uh-huh.
Did you do that yourself?
No, I got the computer as a second edition.
I see, a new computer.
So somebody gave this to you, and they had already been using it, right?
Yes.
Yeah, there's likely some leftover junk in there that they had, and
over time
these things tend to decay, and our rule of thumb is if we hear 98, we usually recommend to reinstall to clean all that decayed leftover software pieces
out
of there.
And what Miles was saying is that Microsoft has discontinued support of Windows 98, the operating system, and therefore security patches are not being added to it. So it's a dangerous thing to run.
Even if you do get it cleaned up.
If you do get it running. So I think the recommendation I'd have for at this point is to find a friend who's had some geek knowledge and have them install Windows 98 on this machine for you.
Yeah.
Or if you're really just using this for internet, you could always try putting Linux on it. Which
yeah,
might
but then
be
how's
he going to
get a copy of it?
You could download it from the web. I don't know.
Well, you can go to ubuntu.com and they'll send you a CD for free.
He can't do that. He can't get online.
You go to the library.
Yeah.
I mean, just give him your address.
Ubuntu?
Ubuntu. Ubuntu.
UBUN
Uniform Bravo Uniform November Tango October
Ubuntu.com.
.com.
Nick.
Ubuntu. We'll put it on our website.
Good luck, Nick. That's a difficult one. Brand new machine.
Not a happy story.
Yeah, the issue with that one is if they, if he was going for DSL or cable or some other broadband where you would also want to have a home gateway kit.
The security
or like
problem.
a router gateway, that would be a lot safer than going through a modem through 98, which means that you're connecting directly to the internet, and Windows 98 has
known flaws
that aren't ever going to be fixed.
You are listening to Geek Speak. Right now, we're taking your calls with questions and comments of technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800, 476-2800, or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877, 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can go to geekspeak.org, assuming you can get online. Again, that's geekspeak.org. Click on Contact Us, and we'll get that question, comment through email. GeekSpeak is supported by Cruzeo Internet, offering DSL broadband, computer rentals, and tune-ups. Cruzeo has retail stores in downtown Santa Cruz and Watsonville. More information can be found online at cruzeo.com or by calling 459-6301. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. The geeks this morning are Miles Elam and Drew Meyer. We're taking your calls with questions and comments of technology. Anything you'd like to ask, we will answer. 476-2800. Again, 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-KUSP. Of course, go to geekspeak.org to get us questions in email form. Just click on Contact Us. Should we go ahead and take another call, guys?
Sure.
All right.
No, not another call, please. Make them go away.
A whole nother half hour of us being wrong on air.
For free.
Yay! From Boulder Creek, Maureen, welcome.
Hi. I emailed you guys, but I wasn't sure if it got through, so I thought I'd call.
That sounds good, because we got it from all directions. Oh, I see your email, so we'll start reading while you talk.
Marnie.
Okay, great.
Oh,
is it Marnie?
It's Marnie.
Marnie, what's up?
Well, all of a sudden, McAfee's got this new upgrade that I downloaded, and then they've gotten all these patches and dramas. It's totally slowed down my machine. It runs through this loop of wanting to scan my computer and then restart it, and I couldn't get it to end.
Mm-hmm.
So I've just uninstalled it, and I went and bought Norton. I'm tired of it. But I was wondering if you guys have heard anything. It happened on my husband's computer, too.
Okay, let me ask you a couple of questions, and then we'll give you an opinion. How's
okay.
That? This is a McAfee software that do you have a high-speed broadband web connection or?
50? Yeah, DSL.
DSL. All right. So did you buy this on a CD at the store and install it
No, I bought it last year, and I just downloaded it off the web. And I've put it on, gone through a couple of laptops now, and I've put it on all my laptops, and it was running fine until this new huge upgrade came down the line a couple weeks ago.
And you applied the upgrade to the software that you already had installed automatically, sort of, or you clicked the go button.
Yeah, click here for updates, uh-huh. So I did.
And it started to really bog down and...
Mm-hmm, and I uninstalled it and reinstalled it a couple times, and it still keeps doing the same thing.
And you've gone now to Norton, which you bought at the store on a CD?
No, I bought it online and downloaded Norton.
Okay, and how's Norton working?
Fine. This is the first time I bought McAfee. It was last year. I've always done Norton, and then all my IT friends said, "Oh no, McAfee's better." So I bought McAfee instead. You know, you have to do it every year.
So McAfee has two versions of the product, and I'm a fan of one, and I don't know much about the other. So here's my take on things. They have this thing called the Internet Security Suite, and we even talked about this last week on the show.
Oh, I should listen.
You can go download it from the site if you want. But the cool thing is they keep all the intelligence back at their data center. They have a number of network operating centers all across the country. So they have these gigantic servers, and they have them connected directly to their labs, and they do all the updates and testing and product development there. And then they push these little trickle updates out to your computer, and your computer automatically is updated all the time, and you don't have to install very much difficult, heavy stuff on your computer, and it's a really low burden on your local machine because all the trickles are coming from the network operating center. So I like that design tremendously, especially for a consumer, because you don't have to think, you don't have to learn in the software, you don't have to be an expert.
And that's a perfect paradigm. And a lot of the virus application developers do the same type of thing. And a lot of the software is coming down to these definitions of new viruses and such.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened with her, though, it sounds like what happened with you was that you got a mass update, which means they did a version revision.
That's what it seemed like, a version revision. I don't know enough to know to say for sure.
Yeah.
But that's what it seemed like, was a
so
big, huge thing.
Their other product is the more old-school version, and they just started this internet security suite thing, I think, within the last year. So you might have the old version, which is download a big glob of software. It's an independent engine that runs right there on your computer. And
yep, that's what I've got.
Okay. So obviously there may be some drawbacks to that, and number one of them is you've got this big application running on your computer all the time.
It takes up a lot of my power.
You got it.
Like.
So the internet security suite is something that I've seen good results with. I use it on my machines at home. That all my Windows machines have it because we have a subscription through my company, and we see our customers using it as well, and they don't they don't have complaints like what you're telling me right now.
Okay.
I think all of the big three, CA, Norton, and McAfee, are going to models like this. So, and they're all very similar. It's really not going to make a big difference to you.
Maybe that's what I just got from Norton.
The thing that you've done that is really is wonderful and what we kind of recommend is you went ahead and purchased an app from one of these big guys, and what that comes with is service. So you should be able to call them on the phone, and I bet they'll be able to say, oh, this is what you need to do at this point, and it won't be that hard. But you've already uninstalled the entire thing?
Mm-hmm, I didn't like it before. It blocked some emails, and it wasn't running
like
the Norton before,
okay.
And so I just went back to Norton.
There's nothing wrong with going with Norton, I would say.
Yeah. No, if you've already paid for it and installed and it works, then you're fine.
Okay,
but
I haven't heard much. If anyone else had these problems or if we were the only ones.
I'm sure you're not the only ones.
All right.
Thank you so much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
The ever-present virus security question.
That's Drew Meyer. Also in the air room is Miles Elam. I'm Lyle Troxler. God, I don't know if I can get any of our names right today. We're taking your calls with questions and comments of technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800, or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Those numbers are really more applicable for California, and specifically 831 area codes. But if you're outside of California listening in, please give us an email, we'd love to take your question as well. Email address is actually a form online to reduce the amount of spam we get. So you go to geekspeak.org, and that gets emailed to us when you click on Contact Us and fill out that form. So please do so if you'd like. We have, from Santa Cruz, Patrick. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Good morning, guys.
Good morning. Patrick.
I have just kind of a general question about backups generally, but in specific with regard to my circumstance, we're running Windows Small Business 2003, and we have a tape drive, and we used to run Yosemite. It's a backup.
Oh, yeah. Very
program.
Familiar. Doing great. Keep going.
Okay, and then we had some difficulty with that, and also then the server, the stuff we were backing up became so large that we went to a larger format tape. We just changed to ArcServe. And my question is, how do I know that everything that it says is backing up is in fact backing up without a total recovery, you know, from start, you know?
Yep.
How do you know that it's really there? That's the concern.
Jeez, man. This is a perfect question. Good for you.
Yeah, there are two possibilities there. One is that a lot of backup software will have a verify step, and what that's doing is reading off the tape and then comparing that to the contents of the hard drive. Can you actually read that data off? Ultimately, if you really want to test it out, get another piece of hardware and actually try a restore.
But the verify step is available in almost
very
all
reliable,
of them, right?
Yeah.
And that's the way to go. I mean, that's what
so
I would do.
That's true, but it doesn't solve the problem of human error, right? In ArcServe, you've gone and selected which directories and files you want to be backed up, right? You've set up a job.
That's right.
The only way to know if that will work in the case of a disaster is to pretend that there's a disaster and do a restore. And
so you've got to go get a server and restore a blank server?
You don't have to. You could restore to a different section of your current server or to a different machine.
But, Drew, if you did a verify step, it's going to ask for all the tapes that you need. It's going to step you through the process. It's going to read and check.
The verify just looks at the quantity of bits that were recorded versus the quantity that were asked to be recorded. Tallies it up and says, yes, there's a same
there's
amount
no
of data
tape.
Here.
Right.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. So it's slick, but it's not perfect. You know, if this is your business, really, then...
Yep.
How it's pretty important to check this out.
How frequently did you buy ArcServe?
How recently, you say?
Yes.
This is just a recent install. And the reason for the question this morning really relates to the fact that I went in this morning to take... So we do incremental backups throughout the week, and then on Friday night we do a full backup, and I went in to grab that full backup tape and said, well, you know, we stopped somewhere in the middle.
Yeah.
And I'm going, oh, well, how do I know you don't really always stop somewhere in the middle?
You got it. This is a classic backup tape problem, and everybody has it, and it's a problem now.
But you have a company that spends a lot of resources to make backup extremely reliable, ArcServe, and therefore, it seems to me the best thing to do is to follow their best practices and read through their manual and follow exactly what they're saying and hold your fingers. Drew, you're kind of shaking your head. What do you think?
It's not CA's business that's on the line here.
I mean, we've got everything from all the engineering drawings, all the source code for our software, all the financial data, all that stuff is up there.
You know, how many people are in this company?
About 18.
And you have a small business server from Microsoft?
Right.
And is it the small business server edition of ArcServe? Do you know?
Is there a special? I'd have to ask the IT guys. I presume it is.
Okay. How big is your? How many terabytes or gigabytes of data are you talking about?
It's about 200 gigabytes.
And so, do you have a single LTO drive, or do you know?
It's a tape drive.
And it just has one tape in it.
One tape, VXA tape.
Oh yeah, great. The other thing you can consider is,
shouldn't he have a second tape?
Well, disk to disk to tape would be another alternative here. Buy a cheap, economical server, like a Snap server, would be one choice that you then tell ArcServe to back up to, and then also back up to tape. And
who makes Snap servers?
Snap servers are made by Adaptec right now.
Mm-hmm.
You could get one for 200 gigabytes. You could get one for easily less than $1,500 or less than $1,000,
mm-hmm.
and it would have RAID on the drive, so you'd have failure proof against the drive's failing, and then you'd be able to do a backup to the disk, which is much faster for you to restore in the case of a real problem.
And then you do a tape backup
off
that.
Yeah, you can continue to go off to the tape.
250 gigabytes. Yeah, who would have thought I would have said 250 gigabytes? That's kind of small, isn't it?
Yeah, it is small, but it's a priceless small, right?
Yeah. Yes, it is. It can't be restored easily.
How long has your company been going?
Our first products were shipped in 2001.
So you've got years of a whole bunch of employees working.
Stuff.
What do you do?
We build surface measurement systems for the semiconductor industry and others, the academic industry and so forth. The thing about the backup is right now we use the tapes as the takeaway backup, so we've always got that in case of disaster.
Yep.
But we've got a mirrored drive. We've got mirrored drives on the server.
Okay.
So shouldn't that resolve the issue of, well, one of the drives is
what happens if the server gets a virus?
Then that goes throughout both drives.
Yeah,
I guess,
you're right. That's one way to do it. The other consideration, I mean, you're too big to go with DVD as a backup. There's just, you know, who's going to sit there and burn DVDs? It's going to take a bunch of them. But you could use one of the online backup service providers, which is rapidly growing for companies your size. AmeriVault is one. There's a company called Iron Mountain that offers a service, and they're, I think they're about less than $20 a month. And that then gives you the confidence, assuming you have a broadband connection, which I'm sure you do.
Yes.
It runs every night over the internet, sends it to their servers. They're responsible for all the tape backup of their servers and the availability of their servers. And they leverage the scale here. They have giant servers
with lots
of companies.
You're basically outsourcing your backup.
Yeah.
And that's one way to do it, too.
And it's not that expensive, but you've got a whole whole idea that your data, which is the core of your business, is
elsewhere.
Yeah. And, you know, of course, they're going to be very responsive to the idea of protecting your data. But, you know, hacking occurs. And then, of course, you have the whole idea that they have tape backups that, you know, who knows their business flow. So it depends on how paranoid you are about it. What you're asking is a great question, because I'm always telling people backup, backup, backup. But then there's this whole idea that we have this faith in the backup systems.
Yeah.
You know, I do multiples, and I make sure that, you know, my copy of the files that I find really important are good, and I've got a couple versions of them so that if something starts deleting files, I don't actually migrate that deletion. You know, I always add to. But it's amazingly complicated. I think that going with the company you're with ArcServe and trying to get their best practices is a great way to do it. And then having another backup is a good way to go.
Okay, fair enough. We'll do that.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. All right, bye-bye.
That was Patrick from Santa Cruz. We're taking questions and comments of technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800. Toll free at 1-800-655-5877. This is GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, Miles Elam and Drew Meyer. In Santa Cruz, Philip, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. Hi. Hello.
Hello.
So I just got a new laptop, runs XP. I'm wondering whether to let my son use MySpace on it, because on my old computer, he would be on MySpace for a couple hours, and then afterwards it always seemed like things were running slower and there was problems. I'm wondering if that was just in my head.
What happened to your old computer that you just replaced?
Well, it was the school computer. I think it was back to school, yeah.
How old is your son?
He's 13, and he mostly seems to be chatting with friends. Yeah. I've told him he can't take any surveys, and he said, okay, I'm not taking any surveys.
And the chatting with friends going through MySpace, is he installing any other applications?
He says he's not, but I'm not looking over his shoulder.
And another thing, is he using Internet Explorer? Because you should absolutely not use that browser with MySpace.
No, we're using Firefox.
Okay.
How do you feel about that, Miles?
I'm serious. That's just the most targeted browser, and that's the largest where most community exploits are going to be going to, yeah. And MySpace is a hostile environment.
So let your 13-year-old play there?
Yeah.
What about that?
I mean, from a computer security perspective. Yeah.
There are
security problems.
There's a lot more stuff he shouldn't be doing on MySpace. He shouldn't be talking about school sports, what school he goes to. I mean, there's all this stuff that...
Yeah, and you shouldn't be clicking on any ads that say, play this game to get a free ringtone.
Right.
Because that's something I see all the time on MySpace, and I keep looking at that going, oh, man.
It's interesting because it's very possible that he's getting something from a friend that's a picture that's really funny, and actually it's an application that's running and infecting your machine. I mean, that's a possibility. You really have to do with you trusting the user. There is a whole package from Microsoft, and I wish I remember the name of this, that restricts the user access, and you can actually install it. And it almost makes sense if you're doing risky behavior to run yourself in that environment where you're a restricted user that can't install applications, can only do certain things.
Okay.
And when you're in that, it's... do either of you know what I'm talking about?
Well, you can always, on XP, just have a different account. That
doesn't help very much.
Privileges.
It doesn't help very much because the write privileges is pretty strong anyway.
True.
This poor kid, he's 13, and you're going to try to limit his access. Give him his own machine or give him a Linux box, and if it goes up in smoke, you haven't lost very much.
Yeah, you really could spend like $300 and get a computer for this child.
Because right, he's not... It's not like he's...
Trash.
Oh,
yeah.
I actually have a really good idea. Keep the same computer. Give him a bootable Linux CD.
Oh, that's a great idea.
That, it's not mounting the hard drive locally. You just boot off that CD. He can do all the web browsing
wants. We solved your problem. There you go.
Yeah. He can do all the web browsing he wants because it comes with a web browser, but you're not saving to the local hard drive.
You don't save anything, actually.
So, Philip, we're talking about, you can go to, again, my favorite is Ubuntu, and download a version of an operating system, which you can then record onto a CD-ROM.
Okay.
And then you stick the CD-ROM in when the computer's powered off. You push the power button, and it boots from the CD instead of the hard drive.
Is it pretty easy operating system that a 13-year-old could use?
Absolutely.
Yeah, there's an icon that says, open up a web browser.
And it'll be Firefox will already be there, so he knows exactly what to do.
But this is a specific, it's not an install CD. What is it called, bootable Ubuntu?
It's called a live CD.
Yeah, it's the desktop edition of Ubuntu now.
Gotcha.
So the live CD is where the computer actually runs from. It never touches the hard drive. He can go out and surf and do all this stuff from the CD. And when you're done, you turn it off, the CD stops, back to zero.
Oh, that sounds great. What's that website again that I can get that from?
I think
Ubuntu.com.
I think we should put instructions on our site about this because it's not just downloading. Yeah, okay, cool. Miles is going to put a little bit of information up.
Ubuntu, UBUNTU.
Go to our website in about 10, 15 minutes.
Go to geekspeak.org and click on today's show, which is... Miles will have a little detail on how you do this. But the general idea is you stop using your local hard drive completely and you use this CD, which can't be changed.
That sounds great.
It's nice and safe. And it makes a lot of sense. I think I might do that for my kid as well because it's a lot faster. Yeah. I like this idea. The only issue you'll have is that if he's running any games and stuff for Windows, they won't work and you can't really eject the CD and keep running the
machine.
Right,
but this is a whole other issue.
Just web browsing.
Yeah, he just wants to look at MySpace, right?
He's just talking about who broke up with who or who's getting together with who.
I like it. I think that's a wonderful solution. Thank you, Miles and Drew, for thinking
that. And it's cheap. If it doesn't work, you haven't lost anything.
Yeah. Philip, good luck.
Thank you very much.
Oh, I'm going to be there pretty soon. I have a 4-year-old, and he's, yeah. All right, from Monterey, Joe, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hello.
Hi, it sounds like you've taken our advice in the past.
Oh, yes, I have.
I'm so sorry.
Thanks for being there for a novice like myself. I have AVG at your advice, and that's a free antivirus, and it seems to be, pretty efficient. So the question is, my Norton antivirus is about to expire at another $35 renewal. You think I'd be okay just staying with AVG, or what would be the risk if there is any dropping to Norton?
Are you running both right now?
Yeah.
And they both work?
Yep.
Don't do anything.
Don't mess with it. That's very unusual.
It's not very, but I would see that it would slow things down, right?
Typically, the two of them don't like to be on the same machine at the same time. The two antivirus programs. I don't know about you know, specifically Symantec and AVG.
When they're both active doing their thing, they're both scanning the machine and looking for problems. And if they're both doing it at the same time, you're just kind of doubling your effort. But it is safer. I mean,
Yeah. The only time I had a non-compatibility problem was with a firewall. You know, really a big no-no.
You can only have one firewall up. Yeah,
one firewall. But I think something in the AVG, information initially, said it wouldn't be incompatible with other.
Yeah.
That's so cool. I don't know.
How much is the renewal going to cost you?
$35 a year.
And what's the new? What's the price if you let it expire and buy it new later?
That I didn't look into. I guess I'm just trying to avoid the renewal fee if
sure.
I can, and then
yeah.
I'm wondering what.
Well, we've got some complaints recently that AVG is starting to kind of do some ad pushing. You know, they need to support their business model, which is basically giving away their free version and hoping that people upgrade to their paid version.
Mm-hmm.
And so they do some bouncing of ads to you. So if you're willing to take that, but it sounds like you're already doing that.
I can tolerate a few ads to avoid the cost.
Well, I think if you're willing to save the money, that makes sense. I also have to say that, you know, no security efforts are completely safe, and eventually you might get a virus. And
$35, man, that's awfully cheap for world-class support from Symantec in your back.
Okay, so you're leaning to go ahead and invest that kind of money.
If you don't have a problem.
Are you going to do it, Drew? Do you pay for it, Norton?
Well, I have a different situation.
Yeah, Drew's cheap.
No, I like I told that caller, Marnie, earlier, I have an access to McAfee for free, so.
Yeah, well, that makes a difference because the price is right for you. But
When I didn't have the situation, I was paying for it, and I was using CAs because they had a good product at the time.
Okay.
And which one was that?
It's called
CSA?
No, Computer Association makes an antivirus for consumer CSA. Antivirus for.
Okay.
I'll find out here and tell you in a second.
Okay, well, in any case, so you do pay for it. You just right now you get a good big boy for free. True.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I get a big boy for free that's really lightweight on my machine.
And if you didn't, you'd be buying one.
Yeah, because, you know, I don't want to deal with the wrath of Edith Meyer wedding cakes if there's a problem.
Which is your wife's website. She makes cakes in the Monterey Bay area.
Well, she does, but, you know, if without a computer, she's not making anything except me unhappy, so.
I think her unhappy. Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's right.
Yes. thank you so much, Joe, for the call.
So your bottom line is go ahead and invest the $35.
It's awfully cheap for the protection. It's, you know, the pain of going through a virus infection is more than $35
in my mind. Oh, yeah. So at that point, I'm willing to pay double when it happens.
Yeah, that's
there
right.
You go.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Joe.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We're taking calls with questions and comments about technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800, 476-2800, or 1-800-655-5877. Again, 1-800-655-5877. We're going to go now to Santa Cruz, where we are, actually. Hal, welcome. What's your question?
Actually, it was just another DSL, another Linux suggestion, which is a damn small Linux.
Ah, DSL.
Linux.
Yep.
And that fits on a CD. I've used it, and it comes with office.org and, you know, the whole everything you need on a CD. It's awesome.
Okay, thanks. We'll put that up as well.
Thank you so much.
Sure, bye.
So he's doing the CD thing totally safe for running your computer with another user who's doing anything you want by running a small, what's called live CD. It makes a lot of sense.
The CA product is called eTrust Antivirus.
Oh, thank you very much, Drew. All right, from Santa Cruz, virus question from John. Hi, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi, thanks. Another virus question. Well, first of all, I have the opposite experience as that other caller, Marnie, where I've had Norton, and I thought it was bogging my system down, so I got rid of it and got McAfee. Now it's, and I think it's the newer one. I just got it, the one that you were talking about. But the question, that's not really my question. It's being worried about this stuff bogging my system down. I disabled the active virus scan that always, every time you access a file, it scans it.
Sure.
And it's always giving me warnings like, you're not really protected, you're not really protected.
Mm-hmm. And pretty soon you ignore them.
I've got the, you know, email, it scans anything coming in.
You have that on?
And I've got that on, and it does, you know, I can do a regular hard drive scan, so I feel like I'm protected because I've got all the entry points blocked, but I just don't want it to scan every time I open any kind of file.
It sounds like you're being pretty wise about your use. I think that you're probably in a pretty good shape. You want to make sure that if you're not doing the all the time scanning, that you're regularly scanning. You know, have some kind of period where your machine just scans the entire system. That's really important. Checking your email when it comes in is really important. And if you start doing like a web browsing, you're looking for some obscure driver, or you're downloading stuff through a web browser, you might want to turn it on at that point, because you're kind of making yourself more vulnerable to that kind of insertion of bad code into your machine.
Right.
But no, it sounds like you're doing pretty well. I would just say that when you're doing risky behaviors, turn that live back on.
Yeah, makes sense. Okay, thanks.
Well, thank you very much for the call.
Yeah.
I think we're going to take one more call today. Ray from Salinas, welcome to Geek Speak.
Thank you. I was panicked, didn't think I'd get on. I have a question about, I'm becoming a day trader, and the equipment is just, you know, it's the guts of the whole thing, and if it doesn't work right, you can be really seriously in trouble.
Yeah.
Is it possible to run a couple of machines at the same time off your same DSL connection?
You bet.
Okay, just run two machines then and get it all going.
Run
the
six.
Other thing is, just an idea.
But just one second, Ray,
hang on.
You can. You get a local router, and lots of times your DSL or cable will actually have multiple connection points, Ethernet ports in the back, and you can plug in multiple computers. But if you're relying upon this as your main business and your DSL goes down, all the machines don't access the Internet. So what would be... You know, if you've got a lot of money invested in this, and this is like, you know, you make a mistake and you're losing thousands of dollars, then go ahead and get cable and DSL and have a computer hooked up to both.
Okay.
And then you're set. You know, you're really redundant. Of course, then you want a battery backup that can allow you to last for a while, and that costs an investment.
And a surge protector, naturally. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And you can do all this. You could basically run your home as a redundant system, you know, for, I don't know, $500.
Okay, so you'd recommend cable and DSL.
Well, this depends on how much money you're talking about.
Yeah, it's the point is the connection's critical.
You can literally lose $1,000 in 5 minutes.
Well, then
if the connection goes down and you don't know how to fix it, it's not on your end, then it's expensive.
And they don't seem to be very sympathetic about that.
If you feel like an extra $60 a month and a $1,500 investment of another computer is worth that risk, you know, then go ahead and do that. You're basically going to double your DSL or cable costs, because they both cost about $60 a month.
Put it this way, are you making more than $60 a month in your trades?
I need to make about $500 a day.
Well, then $60 is no big deal.
Yeah, I would definitely add a redundant system and definitely go buy a battery backup. Now, the battery backup system's interesting, because normally what you do with battery backup is the power goes off and the battery backup starts beeping.
Yeah.
By the way, don't run CRTs or laser printers. Get an LCD, which is a flat panel. Use that. And then for a laser printer, do not plug into your power supply, because it'll drain it too fast. Okay, so now you've got your computers on these backups, and they're going to start beeping, and you got about 5 to 10 minutes before the machine dies.
And you're done.
Then you've got to close down everything you can and sell everything you want, whatever, and then you're done. So it depends on how much time you want, and that's how much battery backup you should buy.
All right. It's infrequent, but it does happen.
Well, thank you so much for the call. We do have to go.
Any chance you guys can have a day trader for a guest?
We'd love to send us an email. Please do. Geekspeak.org.
I don't mean me. I mean somebody who really knows what they're doing.
Oh, I see. if you got a name, I'll do the footwork. Thank you so much for the... just give us an email. Thank you so much for the call.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You're listening to Geekspeak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, Geeks Miles Elam and Drew Meyer. GeekSpeak is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry. Using digital technology for less radiation, offering one appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. Drew, Miles, thank you so much for being on GeekSpeak today.
Our pleasure.
Always a pleasure.
Answering the phone every week, Rick Fellman, thank you so much for making available to people that want to call us. And to those that called in, thank you so much for making GeekSpeak what it is. Without you, it would just be us geeking out. And who wants to listen to that? I kind of want to say that next week we're going to have a day trader on, but I don't know if I can do that kind of footwork within a week. So if you are a day trader and really know what you're doing, wrote a book about it or something, please give us a call or go to email, geekspeak.org. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. GeekSpeak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Auto, on the web at kosp.org. For KOSP and GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell.